Welcome to Real Leadership, the podcast that cuts through the noise to focus on leaders who make, move, and process things in the real economy. Together, we'll discover the strategies and hard-earned lessons from pragmatic, gutsy leaders who operate in a world that is more steak than it is sizzle. Right here, we dive into their stories, challenges, and triumphs to go beneath the surface to the very heart of leadership in the real economy. I'm your host, Jim Weaver, Chief Operating Officer of the Owning Group, where we believe that real leadership does indeed matter. Let's go.
Understanding your labor market is crucial for successful recruitment. Onan Staffing's Recruitment Strategy Guide provides insights specific to your geographic location and the positions you're hiring for. Our Recruitment Strategy Guide delivers a clear snapshot of your labor market and actionable intel to tackle market-specific challenges. With Onan's expertise, we help you navigate and win in your competitive landscape. Empower your recruiting process with the insights you need. Learn more about Onan's Recruitment Strategy Guide at onanstaffing.com/strategy. I am really excited about this episode. Today, we're joined by Bill Kennedy, who is the CEO of not one, but two really pretty large companies. In 2021, Bill became CEO of OTC Industrial Technologies. That's company number one. They are the largest industrial distributor and service provider in the United States, or one of them anyway. During his tenure with OTC, OTC has grown revenues by more than 43% and increased earnings by 78%. That is a two-year run. So that was impressive. And then in 2023, Bill also became CEO of Arrowhead Engineered Products, a global distributor of aftermarket replacement parts. These companies add up to well over $2.5 billion in annual revenue, and they are both owned by the private equity firm Genstar Capital, thus the connection. Bill graduated from Elmhurst University with a Bachelor's of Science in Business Administration and received his MBA from the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. Bill has over 30 years of experience leading numerous organizations as an executive, and Bill is also an author. In his book, The 80/20 CEO, is set for release and is available for pre-order now. Welcome, Bill.
Oh, it's great to be here, Jim. You called me right when I was coughing. So it's wonderful to be on here. I got to tell you, you do a terrific opening. I'm just going to follow you around. I need a theme song and an opener.
You might have been hypnotized or something.
I was. Well, it was amazing.
Let's go to the OTC story. $700 million to $1 billion in under 3 years. And that's great top line growth. And in addition to that, your bottom line growth significantly outpaced that impressive top line growth. Tell me that story.
You know, it's an interesting story, and I'll just give you the punchline. It's really all about the team and getting everyone focused around a common goal. And so many people say that all the time. It's like, oh, it's my people and what they do. It is so true. The key, though, is you've got to set out a clear process, a clear path that you're going to get them there with. And that's what we did. We got our leadership team together. We came up with a very simple, where do we want to be? What does good look like? We picked that out and we worked backwards from there. And we used the process that we've been using for over 30 years now of focusing on the critical few. And that's really what we wrote the book about.
Okay, so what does that look like? I think one of your upcoming book is, or maybe this is the theme to the one that's coming out. It's, what to do in the first 100 days. Or you wordsmith that for me, but that's the gist of it. So what does the first 100 days look like when you come into a situation like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. the easiest or the most logical time to do it is either you get a new CEO or you do an acquisition or something like that. So you have a true day one, a day zero, and this is what we're looking for. So when you start with that day one and you go out 100 days, and 100 days is, if you will, theoretical. It actually came from Roosevelt when he got elected into president. He said, what we're going to do our first 100 days, and had one of the most, whatever how you feel about Roosevelt isn't important, but he passed over 77 laws in 100 days, something that had never been done, and really saved the country during a time of war. Well, it's the same thing here. You try to get everyone focused on something. Now, the key is, what are you going to get them focused on? And our process lays it out very, very straightforward. So the first one is, you got to go get a goal. In private equity, it is as easy and as straightforward as any place that you can ever be, because private equity, they exist for a lot of reasons, but the number one reason is they're trying to take and they're going to sell that company, and they're looking for a certain return on the money. If you look at public companies, they kind of have an infinity horizon, lurch from 90 days to 90 days every quarterly earnings, a lot of distractions. If you look at a private company, it's typically values driven, which is whatever the value of the owner. So if the owner, if he likes to go turkey hunting, then you're gonna sell a lot of turkey calls, right? If he likes to have big boats, you're gonna have that. A lot of them, though, like to give back to their community and their people, and that's what they focus on. Private equity is really about maximizing the return on your invested capital. And since you know what that is, you know it going into it, it's just a mathematical formula. So the first thing you do is you get your team together and you ask yourself and you ask your team, what is that number that we have to achieve to exit this business? So that's number one. There's no conversation around it. There's no discussion around it as far as, is that number right or not? It's contractually driven. The second step you do, which typically takes about 30 days, is you come back together and you say, given the size of that number, the order of magnitude of that number from wherever we are to where we need to be, kind of scopes the price, what's the strategy that we're going to use to get there? Generally, that's in your core. So if you're a manufacturer of pumps, you're probably going to stay in pumps. If you're a manufacturer of outdoor power equipment, you're going to stay in that, and so on, and things like that. So it's the strategy it takes to hit the goal. The third one, and this is where most companies, I think, fail at, is how do I organize myself to go execute that strategy? What happens in that one is a lot of times you say, well, I'm at 100, I got to go to 200. In order to do that, I really need to get very aggressive in the air control space, whatever that means to that company, right? And then they say, oh, well, in order to do that, I need to take and shift my people around. What a lot of times people do is they just give more work to the same group that's been doing everything. There's no extra hours. There's no different time in the day. We're all operating with 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. So you organize, you reorganize yourself. And then the final one is, what are the actions we have to take in order to go do that? So just to kind of sum it up, get a goal, pick a strategy to hit that goal, right? Organize your company so you can actually execute the strategy, and then put everyone on the actions to go do that. Because in 100 right. days, you haven't done a whole lot, right? You've gone around, you've seen people and all that, but you need to make sure everybody's aligned. So
that's really the process. Who is the group of people that you are dialing that stuff in with? Is that the folks from the PE firm? Is that folks within the organization that that have been there? And then if so, how far down into the ranks are you going to put that strategy together?
That's a really interesting question, because you need all three, but you need different things from all three. So in the private equity firm, that's typically going to make up your board. You may have outside or independent directors, but the folks with the money invested are the ones you've got to say, this is the process I'm going through. And based off of that number, that's where the number comes from. This is what we good should look like. If you're a seasoned CEO, then you've got a track record. They say, that's great. We can't wait to see what you do. If not, you might have to take and do a little bit more kind of pre-selling. But those, what you're looking for is support. You're going to need support to get through the process, right? Within your team is your direct staff, the people on the CEO's staff who are the operators. They're the ones actually running the business. They have day-to-day control, hopefully control and command of the business. They need to go do exactly what needs to happen. That means you got to get them focused. And then the final piece, this is the most interesting, I think. as you're coming through it over this 100-day period, you're going to want to have, whether you call it a town hall meeting or all hands or whatever, you're going to want to get everybody together, whether it's in person, on a Teams call or a Zoom meeting, whatever, and tell them not only this is the process we're doing, but these are the results and the actions you're going to see, because for sure you're going to change how people are doing their job, specifically when you reorganize the company. So you need all three. You need to make sure they understand, you give them the right piece of it.
Facing sudden growth or limited by traditional financing? Momentum Capital Funding empowers businesses with real-time cash flow through AR factoring. Get the funding you need and fuel your success. Visit MomentumCapitalFunding.com to learn more.
Okay, back to your pump company analogy. So, I mean, sell more pumps. Okay, we've been trying to do that for 40 years. We have the same team. We have the same. So how do you go about triaging where you shift your energy to? Tell me about that process. Kind of double click on that a little bit.
Yeah, that's the most interesting point of it all, because that's where the math comes in. And this is where it becomes irrefutable, right? This is where we're winning and this is where we're losing. And we define winning and losing by we're making money or we're not making money. So you take your customers and your products and you divide them in very simple. You have your A products and your A customers. You have your B products and your B customers. A lot of people want to say, well, I need A, B, C, D. Not really. You just need, I'm making money here and I'm not making money there. And with your A products and your A customers, that's what's driving your whole business. And so if you take those A customers, they also buy products you don't love. So you have A customers buying B products. And if you take those B customers, they also buy products that you do love, right? So there's good and bad. Now, the one that you really want to get focused on is your B customers and your B products. And those are folks that really, they're not helping your business go be successful. In fact, when we look at it, typically we lose 150% of the money that we make out of the rest of them. So what that tells you is that is your loss-making area. Now, that's an exciting piece to know, because that's where you're going to get the resources in order to deploy those with your best customers and your best product. You have to get resources. And I don't know how it is in your company, Jim, but we don't have any extra money. We don't have any extra people. So we don't have it to go give. We have to quit doing things that aren't working. And we have to use those resources to put them on what is working. So you start out with the math. The math tells you these are my best customers. And almost without exception, it's rare when you see your best customers, right? You've got all their business. You have all that available for you. Your challenge is, how do you go get it?
So do you just ditch your B customers then?
You know, I wish it was that simple, right? And you do ditch some of them, but typically it's more self-selecting. So let me give you an example between two of them, right? So on a B customer, B product, what you'll find is let's say you've got 1,000 customers. Typically, half your business is going to come from 50 customers or less, right? And when you look at the top 200, they're going to represent more than 80% of all your money, all your sales. So out of 1,000, 200 are paying for everything, with generally less than 50 of them paying for more than half. And when you work your way through it and you get down to the long tail of the business, the B customers and B products, you're going to find that when you look at that, over 1,000, right? Let me say it a different way. Over 500 of those customers and products will represent less than 4% of your business. 4%. Now, you will have just as many on that long tail as you do on those good ones, right? And so even if you're wrong, even if they all quit buying, you're only putting at risk 4% of your top line revenue. And candidly, if they do go away, you'll quit losing money. So what do? We take and say, how many salesmen do we have in this category? How many customer service? How many product people? Let's stop making those products. Let's do them in a different way so I don't have to dedicate those resources, because I'm going to go and I'm going to need to get those A customers. So what are some of the things we do? And you will see it probably in your own life. All of a sudden, you can only place an order online. Think about Amazon. When's the last time you talked to someone on Amazon?
I haven't.
Maybe never. But you still they still take your order. It still comes in the way that you want it. But if you're a big enough customers, they actually have a business system out there. You can call in and get help from it. It's the same way here. We make them self-service. We make it so they can only buy certain products. We won't do one-offs. We won't give them terms, as an example. There's no credit. You have to pay for it in advance, or you pay for it with a credit card. If you do pay for it in a credit card, we might charge you a fee for that. And it goes on and on and on. The other thing that we do is that we will lower or remove all commission associated with it, because we're not making any way money on it. Mm. We don't want people focused on it. We want their time and energy to go to those A customers. So we'll typically pay more money on an A customer. We'll typically give them a number they can call in, talk to a human being. We'll actually send a salesman out there, but we have to differentiate it.
You know what we've found? We introduced a tool to help our folks think through their relationships with their clients, their client base. And we have three categories. We can argue about whether two is enough or three, but
doesn't matter.
Yeah, right.
Better
right.
than four.
We have ideal, we have functional, and we have dysfunctional. And dysfunctional needs to move up the scale or out, you know, and then functional, you know, we try to, but what we find a lot of times is clients in the functional but not ideal or dysfunctional category is actually not on them. They have the potential of being an ideal or moving from dysfunctional to functional client if they are sold the right way. And I guess that's what you're talking about with, you know, changing the terms a little bit and letting them self-select out. But how much time, you know, you come into an organization and people have these things that are not, they're in that long tail and they believe in them, and you look at them and you think, okay, I buy that story that if we could probably raise, how do you approach setting the clock on that? Are you it's in the long tail. We cut off the tail. What's your philosophy with that?
Boy, I wish I could just wave my magic wand and everybody do what I want. I can't even get my dog at home to do what I want, much less human beings. So what we do is really quite simple. So we find on the vast majority, everybody agrees. Hey, this is a small account and it's going to be what it's going to be. You said something really interesting. And that is, a lot of those small accounts are someone else's A. So you could be selling Exxon or Walmart. They're the largest in the world, but for you, they're a B account because they just don't buy very much. So they may have extraordinary opportunity, but they're someone else's A, and you're going to have to go take that for them. So if I'm selling, say, air filters, and Walmart buys them, as we know they do, how do I get them to go get mine? If all I've got is a better price, which is what I will rapidly go out of business, right? I've got to sell something they value. Not even though they have the wherewithal, it doesn't mean I can win them. So I accept it, right? So I'll come in, I look at the data, and I'll go on this one end, and maybe it's a no-name customer, but they're an A for us. We love them. They love us. We know that because they place orders and they pay for their bills and they do it regularly. On the other end, it's a giant customer. Everybody knows who they are, but they're not our A customer. And the salesman goes, look, you don't understand. That's the largest company in the world that's doing it. And I go, yeah, you're right. So let's just pick a time. You want 60 days? You need 90? What do you think, 6 months? Is it a rebate program? And invariably what people will say is, well, I've got to give them the best pricing out there. And then I'll say, well, really, do you, right? Can we do a rebate? So there's a negotiation that goes, and typically we'll roll over on it. We'll say, okay, but we'll put some limiting factor, a sunset, a trigger, and something says, if you don't get this in 90 days, we're moving on. Because even though they may be the prettiest thing out there, the biggest customer, if they can't and we can't get them, it just doesn't matter. We have to go to where we're going to go win. That's how you can turn a customer and a company around really, really quickly. You either say get in or get out, but I have to go, right? And so Walmart comes on board, Exxon comes on board, or they don't, right? You got to have a trigger point.
Recruiting top talent is tough. Onan Staffing focuses on people, offering exceptional benefits to attract and retain dedicated workers. Partner with us for flexible, data-driven solutions. Visit onanstaffing.com to learn more.
So your book is called The 80-20 CEO, and 80-20, that approach is one piece of an entire system, and you've got subsequent books coming out. Why lead with the 80-20 CEO as opposed to some of these other gears in your system?
Yeah, you know, really interesting. So I two reasons. So there's five management practices. So there's lean, talent, strategy, M&A, and 80-20. And when you look at 80-20 is really the brains of the organization. Let me give you an example with lean. Lean is fantastic. I've used it my entire career. It has turned companies around for me. However, you can take lean in and of itself and spend $1 million trying to fix a nickel problem. Whereas 80-20, you would look at that nickel and say, I don't need to fix it. It needs to leave the building. I almost just stop. Once I understand where I'm making my money at and what factories I'm making my money in, I then deploy lean into that factory to lay it out in a more appropriate function. I'll put lean to Kaizen, if you will, the entire order function, so that when it comes in, instead of taking it by hand, maybe we're using some type of e-commerce. Lean helps me go through all of that, but it cannot decide where the value's at. 80-20 tells me where the value, lean tells me how to get the waste out. Same thing with talent, right? Super important to most, the people that come in and out, what make us special every day. That talent, there's certain types of people who can work into a system and certain that will and certain that won't. We want to make sure that people are here, they're focused on those critical few, not the trivial many. That means you have to change things. You gotta go with the process. It's like living in a community with a homeowners association, right? If you don't like homeowners associations, you shouldn't live in one, right? We have a homeowners association here. It's called 80-20, and it says these are the rules we're going to deal with.
Yeah.
Not everyone likes that.
Yeah.
It's okay.
How does that – your book is 80-20 CEO, so expand more on what that means and even give some examples of how you – a couple more examples of how you have actually applied that principle to different businesses that you've walked into, situations.
Yeah. There's three key types of people that you're going to need if you're going to successfully turn around a company and run it. Not even just to turn it around, but to really get them marching down a path. So the first is you've got to have the CEO, and the CEO has to make it. This is a condition of how we do business, right? And our role as the person in charge is not to tell people how to go do things. It's to pick what good looks like. You have to say, this is the hill we're going to go take. Whatever it is. Think. I like to use military terms. I was once upon a time in the Navy, and it just resonates with me. I love history and all this kind of stuff. So if we're in a battle, we're saying that's our goal. We're taking that hill. The folks on the ground, the folks that's got to go figure it out, they have to figure out that strategy of how we're going to get there. Their job is to figure it out. And so why is that? Well, I'm not with them every second of the day. I can't tell them what they're going to encounter out in as they're going towards that goal. However, as a CEO, I have to make sure they have two things. One is the skill set to use the tools, and the second one is to understand our culture so they know when to use the tools, right? We want to win, but we want to win under any condition, right? And we want to be experts at what we do. So CEO, first and foremost, has to make doing it a condition of employment. The second group you need is the operators. That's the people who run the business day to day, right? Whether they're running a machine all the way up to running a group, they need to understand what our mission is, what it is we're going to go do, how to deploy those tools, and make sure that the folks out there under their command, if you will, are doing it. The third group that you need is an implementer, someone who's an expert on the tool sets that you have that'll come in and train everyone. Those are the three. Now, you can use outside consultants, and there's wonderful ones out there. I can name several of them. They do a great job. But you have to get it from being someone else, some outside consultant that comes by and every once in a while says, Jim, here's my latest report. So you got to get your team owning it. And if you don't have people who know how to do it, you bring those in, you make it your own, you make it your standard work. But at the end of the day, those operators and those people know what they're doing have to be in your company long term if you're going to have that success. So we started out with the 80-20. Just simply because it starts with the CEO, right? We've got to set that vision and that goal.
You just last year took over as CEO of Arrowhead. So as far as that's a $2 billion in revenue, roughly size wise. Yeah. How many different sites do you have roughly?
Well, we sell in about 50 countries, and globally we have locations in 14 countries. About 6,000 employees.
Okay. So, so you've got to instill a 80-20 mindset into 6,000 employees across multiple countries. What does that implementation team look like? It's got to be an army. Four?
We have four people. We have four people. Four people in the whole thing, right? It's super straightforward, right? So remember, everyone's got to know their role. So I'm the CEO. I come in and said, look, we are who we are. Doesn't matter. This is where, this is the set of situation that we're dealing in. It's a turnaround. And the only time that you get your second job as a CEO is they can't find someone else crazy enough to take it, right? So it's a wonderful business, wonderful people and all that. But we were able to come in and help them pretty quickly, actually. And it, because of really what the private equity, Ginstar has decided to do, and the people there, getting everyone aligned. So we started out with that four-step process, and there was no bones about it. So if you were going to play on the team, you had to take and get in right away. That made a huge difference. You know, I took over a CEO April 9th of 23. We had our kickoff meeting for the goal 6 days later. We started pulling the data at the same time. So within 6 days, we got everybody who ran all the global operations in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We rented a conference room and we went around, and it was a cathartic process, because the interesting thing is people already know. They know if your business is doing well or if it's not. They kind of know where it's at and where it's not. And they may not know why. They may not know how to fix it, but that's what guys like you and I are for, right? We show up and we get it all on the table. We understand exactly what's happening, right? And we understand that we have a process that will get us through it. We may not know the answers. It's not even important to know the answers, but it is for sure important to go through the process. Let me give you an example. So you're not feeling well. You go to the doctor. Does he just open the door and throw in a bunch of penicillin and close the door? No, he comes and he says, Jim, what's happening? What's going on? Where does it hurt? Why are you here? Because you might have a broken wrist. It may not be a virus, right? You need to understand that. And the tool sets that we have here that we use across Ginstar and within these companies are all around what's going on. What does the data tell us, right? So the first thing we're going to be is we're going to be data driven. We call it the leader's mindset. Be data driven. We're going to get that data. We're going to look at it. The second one is be on pace. So don't go too fast. Don't get ahead of your team. You need to talk to them. They need to talk to you. You need to be on pace at whatever it can take. The third one, no surprises, right? Relatives and fish and bad news all stink after 3 days. So you got to let us know what's happening there. And the fourth, and this is the most important one, is results matter. We will not be a company of best efforts, right? We got to win some. We're in the business of winning. We're not going to win them all. Right? Yeah. Progress, not perfection. We're going to do that. So we came into that room. We knew we had a situation. People could not understand what the issue was, right? And the issue turned out to be very simple. We did all the math and we said, what's our strategy? And our strategy was, we will ship our products on or about one day. That was it. So if you got it in by 3 o'clock, the order would go out and you'd have it within one day. That was the whole strategy. There was just three flaws with that strategy. The first one was, we were not shipping in one day. In fact, 63% of the time, it took a week to get to everyone. Second strategy was, since we had taken our footprint from, a handful of sites and maybe $300 million of inventory, to now we had, just in the US alone, over 30 sites and $1 billion of inventory, and we never had the right product in the right place, because we looked at the data. The data said, we were shipping internally more than we were shipping externally, trying to get it in one location for people to go for, right? So we said, we're not shipping what we promised. We have four times the amount of inventory we need. We have four times the amount of facilities we need, just because trying to live to this strategy. But the data told us already the strategy was not working. And people said, no, this is the strategy. It has to work. Right. It's not working. And so we knew without doing anything that the strategy was broken, and we had to put a strategy in that we could live. So what do you think our whole strategy went from and to?
I don't know. Tell me what you think.
We went from saying we're going to have it in one day to we'll have it in 2 days.
That's it.
That's the that's it. That's the whole change. Right. We'll close over 20 sites and get rid of $500 million inventory with that one sentence change. I didn't come up with that. I didn't make that up. Mm-hmm. We just did the math and said, we're not even doing it now, but we are spending as if we are, and it'll run the company
out
of
business. You're spending, trying to do
it. The last year.
You're spending as though you are, but you're not. Right, right.
We're making it worse. We're walking down a factory in Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania, and they said, it's all going out to the customer. We said, oh, really? Well, let's look at it. We pulled 10 boxes off the line. All 10 of them are being shipped to another facility somewhere out in the country so it could go out in a same-day shipment.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is impossible, right? We got to ship it internally, pay all that freight. Half of them were going out to Washington State. And we were in Pennsylvania. And so, yeah, it was – we were living and trying to do what we thought was right, but the data said we weren't achieving it. And the fury and the noise that we were creating was burning cash like it was nobody's business. So – what do you do in that?
You change it. I mean,
Hey, you stop it. You just go, we're not going to do that anymore. And then you say, what's the implications? Now, if I'm going to go to 2 day, which I can do, I already know I can do it. The data tells me I can do it. Then you just go, all right, what do shipping bans look like? How far can I get? How many facilities do I need in order to get 98% of the population in the United States? How many facilities do I need? Well, we had 22. We need 3.
Wow. Wow.
We will wind up with more than 3, right? But just the math tells you, because, you know, shipping logistics has something been around a long time. You can pull UPS's charts. They will tell you how long it takes them to get it across the country. Yep. I didn't have to come up with that. People who are way smarter than I am will tell you, oh, no, the shipping bans say it's this far in this many days. And so now, look, we're an existing company. We may never get it to 3. But if we had a clean sheet of paper, we would have started and finished with 3.
Struggling with high turnover and burnout? Onan Flex addresses these challenges head on, offering a scalable solution with vetted part-time talent to fill staffing gaps. Onan Flex combats worker shortages and ensures your core team isn't overburdened, reducing turnover and enhancing job satisfaction. Empower your workforce and boost your success with Onan Flex. Visit onanflex.com to learn more.
So, as far as the application or getting your organization into the 80-20 mindset, it's not about a learning and development program that helps all 6,000 people start to think this way. It's about a strategy and systems that reinforce 80-20 behavior. Is that accurate?
I think so. So if I'd say it a little bit differently, 80-20 just tells us the data of what's happening. You have to pick a strategy that if you follow it based on this data, you'll win. All right. So what we did at OTC had nothing to do with our shipping and where it was going. That wasn't our problems, right? We had a whole different set of problems. But 80-20 said, this is the data and what's happening based off your current strategy. Now, what do I have to tweak in that strategy? So we came and we looked, it was during the pandemic. We had 70 some sites. Most of them were empty.
Yeah.
Like most places. So I'm carrying all that freight for, and no one's ever going back. So what do?
You got to change something. Yeah.
You get rid of those.
Exactly.
Just go, okay, because I don't need them, right? But what do I need? Well, I do need places. I do have to have service centers and all that. You start and you go, well, where am I winning? The math told us we were winning in service, that we were winning in repair, that we were winning when we had inventory centralized. So we put a DC in. We invested tens of millions of dollars putting more service trucks out, hiring technicians, all that. And then we're spending a lot of money trying to figure out the next piece is that instead of having inventory in some site, how do we put it in the back of a service truck going out? Same thing with Arrowhead, right? Once we figured out what the data told us we could actually do and what customers would pay for, which is the most important, once we understood that, we just start moving towards it. Now, everybody has a great plan, but plans never survive meeting the enemy, right? It's the old saying that goes way back, right? Everyone gets a vote. Your customers get a vote. Your owners get a vote, your employees get a vote. So you come up with these plans and you start making some small moves, and you see what happens, and you adjust accordingly. Yep.
Bullets to cannonballs. Yeah.
That's right.
So how do you go about making... how do you go about goal setting personally and within an organization of that size? I know you have some of this. Your return on invested cash is obviously important to the PE firm, but getting down to the performance or the targets for individual business units, individual sites, and then curious about how you go about it for yourself. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we measure what matters. To start with. And so you really have two different things you want to look at. So in private equity, the only number that matters is EBITDA. That's how we buy them and how we sell them. So that's the number we are for sure going to be focused on. We can argue if that's a good number or not, but it doesn't matter. That's the number that is used to decide what the value of these companies are. So when we comp anyone in the company, it's tied back to EBITDA. And EBITDA is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization. In some ways, it's even a fake number, right? It's what is depreciation, amortization? It's not a real cash number from it. So we use that number across the board, and every bonus we have is tied to that number. It's not tied to some personal objective. It's not tied to you being a better person or not. Those are conditions of employment, right? We want to win by doing the right thing. So if you don't do the right thing, we don't take your bonus. We get rid of you, right? But if you do the right thing, and the business does well, you get paid, and you get paid very well for doing it. So everybody gets comped off of that. The only exception, or that's our goal. A lot of times when we get there, they're in different ways. The only exception is salesmen. Salesmen typically get a commission, right? You can have one or the other, but you can't have both, right? So then everyone's aligned to the same number. We're measuring it the same way with it. And that simplifies absolutely everything that we're going to deal with. Then inside of that, you have a tremendous amount of KPIs, key performance indicators. And you have to be careful. You can overmeasure, but given whatever it is you're doing, so let's say you're looking at engineering, one of the key things you may be looking at is something called a vitality index, right? How many new products by percentage are being produced? So of the sales that are going on right now, how much of those did we come up with in the last 3 years? Is it 3%, 4%, 20%, 30%? Different industries have different requirements. We'll use that. We'll measure that KPI, and that it will be something very key for that engineering group, and we'll talk about it. From it. So we have a process that we use for that. We have monthly meetings that are called MBRs, monthly business review. So we're pretty clever in our naming characteristics. But the way that we get to these is we run an annual strategy process, right? And so when you come in, you take over the business, that first 100 days, that's actually your strategy plan you're walking out with. It's just very shallow, just by the very nature of it. You immediately, if you're in leadership, kick off the next round of strategy. You go ahead and start, even though it feels like you should just be executing, your plans are moving the action plans at that point, and the folks who are running the business are going to take that and push it across the organization, and the meetings will tell you if it's happening or not. That leadership then moves into what we call situation assessment. And that's basically saying, given everything that's happened, so you immediately go from looking at the here and now, you look 1 year out. We typically base it on a calendar. It could be fiscal. But you look 1 year out and you say, so we're in 24 right now. We are planning 25's actions as well as in that rolling 3 year plan, right? So you come out, this is in the fourth quarter. You'll look at the fourth quarter and you'll say, given what I think is going to be happening, this is my situation. Interest rates are going up or down. Competitors are doing this. Market's doing that, whatever it is. And you'll narrow that down to just a handful of items. You'll bring that in and you present it to myself, the CFO, the senior leadership team, executive leadership team, whatever you want to call it. And you will say, this is what I think. We'll push them to pick just one or two things. And typically, it is right in line with what they've been doing before. It's very unusual to take a hard turn in your strategy because you are who you are. If you got to get outside your core, it means things probably aren't working well. So you do that, then you hit to the first part of the year, you go from situation assessment to framework. And framework is nothing more than taking those two or three things and saying, given that this is where I think we're gonna be, you build out, think of it as an outline if you're writing a book, or think, it's just a skeleton of this is what it looks like. You start looking at your resources, You may actually go spend some money to find, maybe you need a market report or maybe you need to hire someone to give it to you. But when you get through that, and that takes a couple months to get through, you come back in, you present it again. There's check-ins and all of this that you go through. You'll present then again back to the executive leadership team. You will say, this is what I've learned and this is what I want to do. This is my strategy, but you don't quite have the numbers yet, right? You're still a little bit up here, but you know what you want to go do. You get an okay there and then you build your business plan. That translates right into your budget. So you'll do that over the summer. And you have now, you know where you're playing, you know the two or three things you're going to be doing and what you're going to get for it. We take that budget that goes right in the beginning, generally August, companies are, but we present that to the board, we get signed off on, that's your plan for the following year. Okay,
so that'd be working 25, and by August, you have your plan for 25, and you've already started that at the end of 23. Yeah.
Okay. We started at the end of 23, and we started at the end of 23, the fourth quarter, and we deliver it typically somewhere in the third quarter, beginning of the fourth quarter, to the board for final.
If bonuses, what's that?
And it's baked.
Yeah,
it's baked, right? I mean, it can change, but everybody knows what they're doing.
It's interesting. We have in some cases bonuses based on net income, and it can sometimes incentivize short-term thinking, you know, or in your case, EBITDA. I mean, EBITDA this year doesn't mean that you've made the right moves to set yourself up for the following year. So, or 3 years out, or maybe you're running your team to the line, or you just double down on this one client, you got all your eggs in one basket. So, how do you balance that out when you've incentivized so heavily on EBITDA this year?
Yeah, so it's interesting to ask it. So once we set it and everything, it's interesting. It's like you take a job, you get your salary and bonus and everything. You negotiate like crazy to get it, but once you're in, you don't actually, at least I find myself and most of you don't sit around and go, did I make $3 today or $4 today or something like that? You kind of set it and you set it aside. It becomes the running of the process and the monthly meeting. So we have a very standardized, we have an MBR. You come in and you talk about, okay, so we call it managing the greens and the reds. So you come in, you're on track. We don't say a whole lot about you, congratulations or whatever. Yeah. It's the reds, right? So what are you doing about it? And so we just drive ourselves constantly into the details of why is this not working? What did we get wrong? And we try to remain flexible about it. And so what I mean by that is you put your budget in for the following year. You put it in somewhere early fall, late summer. And it says next year you're going to do 100. And you get to spend 50 to go do it. Whatever that means, right? You get 100%. You get to spend 50% to go do it. March comes along in that year and things are going crazy good. We will put more money in. Things are going crazy bad. Mm-hmm. We're not going to spend it all. So the budget of what we spend or not, is you got to be able to feather a little on the gas, a little bit on the brake of what's actually happening. People appreciate that because it brings reality into it, right? But most importantly, the budget and stuff is guides, and the EBITDA that we're going to get paid off of is really a guide. I mean, it's in a number. We try, different companies have different philosophy. I've worked for places that every goal had to be stretched beyond stretch, which means you never hit it. And they didn't either pay out or the CEO gave you a gift. Other ones, they set it so low, so everybody gets 250% or whatever. There's a philosophy associated with it that typically allows it to be able to be afforded. We just try to hit our numbers. And since we start out with what our goal is, and let's say our goal, I always keep using it at 100. I really mean 100%, right? We start and say, all right, for us to win, we got to get to 100. And we're going to get there. We know mathematically it's possible in a given period of time. And we're typically thinking 3 or 5 years. It can be whatever it is. That next year's goal that we're looking at is tied to what we originally start with. There's no reason to set a goal that is low or high if it doesn't align with our long-term strategy. If we've got to go from 100 to 200 and we're going to get in 3 years, what does a 120 do for us? Because we're in the game for this event, the selling. We're not in the game just to get better or worse next year. So we will totally focus on what it is. And because we talk about it and we're honest about it, people get it. You may or may not like it for sure, right? But we want to make sure that people get paid in the short run, but most importantly, we're trying to achieve what the mission of the business is.
You mentioned the importance of team. What's a character trait that you wish you could wave a magic wand and instill in everyone that you have in your organization?
You know, first of all, we talk a lot about diversity, inclusion. I love a diverse team. Not about how people look or whatever. I love diverse thought, right? Like how we're going to get there and everything. And having people who are willing to speak up and be part of that process and help us get through it. So that's one. So the most important thing, I think, though, is this continuous learning. I've learned more over the last year than I've learned my entire 30-year or 29-year career before that. And the year before that and the year before that, each time I'm so amazed at how little I know. And if you talk to anyone I work with, they would tell you I even know less than that, right? So this continuous learning is super important. Second piece is the flexibility to deal with change. None of us saw the pandemic coming, but those who did well were the ones who adjusted accordingly and did the best they could and then adjusted again and again and again. And then the final piece is just go get something done, right? Just get up, brush yourself off, and get yourself back in there, because it's not only your career, you know, and when you got thousands of people and they have children and spouses, and we're paying a lot of mortgages and college tuitions and all sorts of things. We have to get this right. People are depending on us. So continuous learning, the ability to brush yourself off and get back in there, right? And the ability to get something done are the three most important things that we look
What's something
for.
You've changed your mind on in recent years? You've been around for a while. What's something you're looking at differently today than you maybe looked at it years back?
I really like people who have failures in their past, right? Which is kind of weird. I guess there's certain kind of failures you can't forgive. I don't know what they are, but there's certain things that just are. But I like people who've had tough times and figured it out and are grateful for the opportunity. So I'm always skeptical when people come to me and say, I'm the best ever at this, and maybe they are, and they're almost doing me a favor. I'm like, I don't need favors. We're in this together. So I like people who are, you know, and, you know, they're kind of humble. And I think I saw this as a book title. So humble, hungry, and hustle, right? You want people who are grateful to be here. And there's the, you know, I meet a lot of people who are super smart, amazing degrees, and have all this. But, you know, you don't have to come here and teach us anything, right? We're just some bunch of simple country people. We'll learn, I guess. But what we really want is someone to help us, right? And people who've had a rough go of it a lot of times are way better and more grateful and create an atmosphere of just genuine thankfulness to be part of something bigger than they are, and they want to win, and they're going to help us win.
Well, Bill, this has been great, really great, practical, actionable ideas, counsel for all of us. The 80/20 CEO, as mentioned, is on deck, available for pre-order. We're going to put links in the show notes to that. I'm excited to pick it up. I read Richard Koch's stuff, the 80/20 principle. It's a great book, but this applying it practically to the executive gig, I'm excited to see it. And having talked to you, I'm even more excited. So, where can folks find out more about you, connect with you, all that good stuff?
Yeah, so I have a website. It's my name, BillKennedy.com. It has my bio and ways to contact me there. And, of course, the book is available in all fine bookstores, be it Amazon or your local bookstore. You should be able to get it through it. The audio book you can download now. The physical book and the e-book will be available February 27th. So I hope hope everyone enjoys it. It was a labor of love to put together. You know, it's one of those kind of things. It took you 30 years and then, you know, maybe a couple years to write the thing. But it's been a wonderful, wonderful journey. And Jim, this has been outstanding. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, yeah. It's been a blast. Thank you so much. Okay. Until next time, folks, keep it real. Thank you for listening. This podcast was powered by Onan, a family of staffing companies providing real staffing solutions to manufacturing, logistics, and food processing companies across the United States of America. To get in touch or learn more about partnering with an Onan Group company, visit us at www.onangroup.com. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time.